more. Baby, it's not nice. Not chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass may dab in the middle of it. Grass may dab in the middle. We are grass may dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness, we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. I'm going to start off with an interview that Alex Jones had with Roger Stone, there, and Roger's going to set out some of the mistakes that the Trump campaign made in not doing enough local advertising and so forth, but they had it so fixed against Trump that I don't know if anything that he did could have won the election. But anyway, we're going to start off with that, and then there's a second clip that Alex had an insightful interview with Max Kaiser about the Bitcoin, and that is just really fascinating. So here we go now with Alex and Roger Stone.
Trump only won in 2016 because of the rise of the vibrant, robust alternative media based in the in the internet. It didn't matter that that network television was against him. Half of cable world was against him. Most of the print media was against him. Most of the mainstream net based reporters were against him. But just with that internet freedom of social media, he was able to prevail. Now, let's fast forward to 2020. What's the difference? Well, they've consolidated on cable, so now cable is almost monolithically anti-Trump. So for the first time in American history, you have control and censorship of all mass communications in the United States, whether it is cable TV, network TV, half of radio. Radio is the last frontier of freedom. And they're trying to smash us there. Don't kid yourself.
So you give better speeches on radio. Your speeches are A+. Your radio is A+, but your speeches are dynamite. Take 10 minutes, or I'll interrupt. Address folks on where we are, how to defeat this takeover, 2022, 2024.
Well, I think that things have to be done in a certain order. In other words, if you can't break the blockade on information, then we can never win another election. Because as Abraham Lincoln said, public opinion is everything. So if you can't rally public opinion, if you can't get the patriots to support your point of view because you can't communicate with them, you can't reach them, then all is hopeless. So those who say, we've got to jump in and change the state election laws, there's not a chance that you can get the critical mass among the public to do that under the current rules of censorship. So first and foremost, even playing within their construct, you can have platforms on the internet which are very difficult to deplatform, and if they're controlled by patriots who are open to all points of view, then you'll have no censorship. That's step one. If you cannot achieve that, don't even think about the next three steps, which are fixing the state election laws to guarantee transparency and integrity. Step three, clean out the weak-kneed, white wine-swelling, green pants-wearing, gutless, feckless, country club Republican geeks who were quick to invite Donald Trump to their fundraiser and desperately needed his endorsement, but then turned on him like the rats that they are. They have to be cleansed from this party. This party is the party of working people now. This party is the party of Trump. It is the party of America First. More important, it's not about a person. It's about an idea. And that idea, the America First wing of the party, is still in the ascendancy. We can crush the rhinos in primaries. But we have to have a purpose. There's no point in nominating a good candidate for president. And I'll be very clear. If Donald Trump's running, I'm for him. 100%. He can count on me. I will be there. I hope the same people who ran the last campaign don't run the next campaign, because the only good thing about Donald Trump's campaign was Donald Trump.
Okay, now we're to that point, and you don't, even though you know they screwed Trump over, And you think it reflects somewhat bad on Trump to show he was screwed. No, it doesn't. It shows how he, like a lion, fought back, in your own words. Give him the real data dump you've not given anybody. Tell him what really happened. You give me big briefings. You predicted it all. You told General Flynn this. You told everybody. You told Trump this. Explain to everybody what really happened so we don't repeat it.
Well, I think that there's a couple things. Early in the Trump administration, I told the president that internet censorship was, in my opinion, the number one problem that stood in the way of his reelection. I underlined the historic role that it played in his original victory, because without the internet freedom that we enjoyed in 2016, he would never have won. Nothing has changed. In other words, the same networks, the same cable networks, the same talking heads, the same leftist intelligentsia that was attacking him in 2016 attacked him with the same ferocity in 2020. But in 2016, he had a platform from which to counterpunch, which is what he does best.
And they slowly cut all that away. But let's get into, so he doesn't get repeated again with other Republicans, that the Republican establishment, which Trump's gotten wise to, it's why he won't let them fundraise in his name right now, they swindled the money, and hardly any of the money raised for Trump went to Trump.
Well, first of all, the president raised $1 billion. $1 billion, which is really formidable. He was a great fundraiser, and he had the confidence of the business community because he brought us a record economy. The problem is that, as a general rule of thumb, in all campaigns, whether you're running for the Austin City Council or whether you're running for President of the United States, 80% of your campaign's funding should go into voter communications.
Mail. No, that's advertising.
It could be cable advertising, network advertising, digital advertising.
Minimum 80%, not bureaucracy.
But. Voter mail, phone calls, voter contact. Not overhead, not consultants, not bureaucracy, and so on. The Trump campaign has the inverse. $600 million gets transferred to a holding company controlled by Jared Kushner. The rest of it is basically squandered. So when COVID hits, and pre-pandemic, Trump is leading Biden by 9. Post-pandemic, he's trailing Biden by 9. When a trained professional looks at that polling, what you figure out is the only votes that moved are African-Americans and Hispanics. Essentially, all other voters remained in place.
So you should target only them.
Because you were doing really well with them prior to the pandemic, and you've lost ground, which means they don't hate you because they were already for you once. You have to reconvince them. So, for example, in some polls, pre-pandemic, Trump was getting a third of the African-American vote, just beneath it.
Or more.
And in the end, he did not finish there because his campaign didn't spend any resources there.
Which, again, was not done by accident. This is 101 failure sabotage.
Well, you know what? Trump is such a great candidate, and he was particularly hampered by COVID-19. And I was looking at it this way. They always ran, last time in this went, traditional campaign against him. They censored him on all media platforms. They trashed him in paid advertising starting September all the way to the end at saturation levels. Normally, no human being could overcome that, but he overcame it in 2016. Jeb Bush, as you may remember, dropped $100 million of negative advertising, trashing Donald Trump, and he was able to respond to it in real time in interviews without spending a dollar. That's theoretically not possible, but he did it. This time, I believe that his set-piece rally format, which is where he excels, forcing the media to cover what he had to say in Milwaukee or in Detroit or in Philadelphia or in Richmond or wherever he is. When Trump can't talk, when Trump can't hit the road, the campaign is frozen.
And they now know that. That's why in 2021, banned off all social media, banned off YouTube. So he needs to get out and give more speeches than just the one he gave at CPAC. Don't you agree?
I do agree, but let's be very clear. When he breaks out of this construct for the last 30 days, he does the same thing he does in 2016. He's a closer. So he's 9 down. Now he's 7 down. Now he's 5 down. Now he's 3 down. I'm convinced that Trump most likely passed Joe Biden by dint of pure hard work.
But you think the election was probably stolen?
The point is, he didn't need millions of dollars to win. He didn't need it in 2016.
So let's talk about this. What can he do now? Will he be healthy enough, looks like it, to run again? Gut level, he looks like. I think he's a fighter. I think if he can think that he's led a movement to try to fix election fraud and at the state level so the Democrats can't repeat this again, then I think he may run again. I think he is going to run again.
Well, I knew both of his parents. They lived into their 90s. They were vital into their 90s. He's got extraordinary stamina. He's from good stock. He's very angry, as he should be, about being censored, about being what he believes is cheating. There's certainly evidence of anomalies and irregularities in the elections. And no, saying that is not treasonous. It's not seditious. It's a reasonable question protected
by...
Well,
the Democrats said they were going to challenge the election no matter what.
Exactly. But again, it's the two-tiered justice system. So if the president wants to run, he will be unstoppable for the nomination and to be the strongest candidate that the party could field. But if he doesn't feel, if he doesn't fix the structural problems that cheated him out of victory in 2020, he's not going to be able to win in 2024. If he goes into the same level of net censorship and media censorship, the same corrupt state election laws, the same gutless Republican Party that doesn't really go to work for him, then I don't see how he wins. If he fixes those things, he's probably our strongest candidate.
If you'll remember or recall right after listening to this, that what Roger Stone also says is that if the same variables apply, you know, like they did in the this 2020 election, then Trump's not going to stand a chance either. So are they going to be able to hold those variables the same or what? But, I mean, we know that the social networks are not going to be for Trump on some kind of a reelection bid in 4 years or a little less than 4 years. So don't think it's going to work quite like they're going. They can rebuild the Republican Party. I think that's possible. But as far as winning a reelection, you know, in 2024, don't know if that's going to work. But here we go with Max Keiser being interviewed by Alex on the Bitcoin. He says that it's a way to get out of the money system that they have built upon all these central banks and all this crony capitalism and monopolistic capitalism. But anyway, here we go with Max Keiser giving us some good insights.
Right. Well, the history goes back 20 years or more, really. It's always been the goal for what are called the cypherpunks, you know, computer engineers and hackers to try to create digital money that would be decentralized, ultimately decentralized. The problem with all the schemes beforehand, and I had this myself when I created the Hollywood dollar and the patent that I have going back to the 1990s, is that you have the situation of it's all being centralized, and that doesn't lend itself to being a competitor to fiat money. But when you have a decentralized hard money like Bitcoin, it does become a competitor to fiat money and to gold. And the reason is that it's indestructible. It's decentralized in that it's replicated on servers all over the world. And there is no way that you can hack in or break into or change this system. There's a fantastic egalitarianism, if you will, in that even if you have a $50 million worth of Bitcoin, you still can't change the network. You can't change the protocol. You can't change the emission schedule of coins every 10 minutes.
And is that why from the beginning, it's been the dominant one and nothing else can rival it because it was done so well? I mean, why haven't the others been able to rival it? Not done as well, didn't have the beginner's momentum? Because clearly now this has been globally adopted. I mean, you see the collapse of resistance, the capitulation. I'm capitulating.
Right. The other coins just failed. I mean, after Bitcoin came out, it was a perfect mix of available technologies that created the Bitcoin protocol that does exactly what it says it's trying to do, and that is to put gold out of business as a better form of gold, digital gold. And then, of course, there were thousands of competitors like Ethereum and Bcash and Satoshi Vision and Tron and just thousands of them, and they've all failed, essentially. And because there's no need for them. They don't do anything.
And I believed you 5 years ago, 3 years ago, when you said they're all going to fail. But now you're proven right again. I'm not kissing your butt. It's true. How the hell are you so right about this?
Because I have been studying this for decades. You know, all the way back to my Wall Street career, I was always interested in virtual currencies, market making, economics, finance. Then I ran a technology company in Los Angeles. And then I became a financial journalist. And then when I discovered Bitcoin in 2011, along with Stacy Herbert, it immediately clicked. I just saw immediately how this fit into the timeline. And also it fits perfectly in with the Occupy Wall Street movement. You know, Bitcoin is a protest movement, and it's the idea is that the people behind Bitcoin and the cypherpunks who gave us pretty good encryption and were able to release encrypted messaging into the wild that was formerly behind the firewall of the military industrial complex. You know,
so
they released
the same revolutionaries have just continued to keep pioneering since PK Dick gave them their name 40 years ago.
Right. So it's just part of the same revolution of giving people the ability to have uncensored communication and to separate state from money. This is one of the most profound implications of Bitcoin. Never before in history have we been able to separate state from money. Every single form of money going back hundreds of years, thousand years.
Back to talus sticks and the British and back to the you know, emperors and the pharaohs of ancient Egypt. It's always been the crown.
The state or the crown issues the money. It's been speculated by people like Friedrich Hayek that you could have private money that was separate from the state, but he didn't see how it could happen unless it was a quirk, almost an accidental occurrence. And exactly this is what happened in 2009. It's almost a quirky little occurrence that Bitcoin was released into the internet. And now we do have separation of state and money. And that's why the state is becoming quite nervous. Because if all the capital ends up moving into Bitcoin like it is, and the market capitalization goes from 1 trillion to 100 trillion to 400 trillion, that means that the nation state, as we know it, is going to go out of business. The central banks are going to go out of business. And we're entering into a new era, kind of a renaissance 2.0.
And is that why, your view on the whole COVID deal, obviously a giant evil power grab, I mean, that's their attempt to stay in control.
Power always seeks more power, and the state always seeks to expand the state, and that's the nature of the beast. But they are up against an impregnable foe with Bitcoin now, and they're just now starting to come to terms with the fact that, and everyone will capitulate eventually, Alex. I mean, you've capitulated here, okay? But everyone will capitulate eventually. And it doesn't matter what price.
Is there a threat from quantum computing to the encryption of Bitcoin?
No. The algorithms and the hashing algorithms that protect the network are in such a advanced state that any quantum computing that certainly nothing existing now, if you project out 5, 10, 15 years, you don't see anything on the horizon on the quantum computer side that would be a threat. And there are folks working on the protocol every single day who are fine-tuning the protocol and releasing improvements to the protocol. And if there was, a five-year advanced suspicion or thought that some kind of quantum attack were to occur, there's ample time to tweak and do what needs to be done. Everyone has an incentive.
Cards and the cash and all that's already infiltrated and overthrown. So all it's like open with the barn doors. Max Kaiser, thank you so much. SwanBitcoin.com/Alex. Go there. $10 free of Bitcoin. It's the place to invest in Bitcoin, in my view. According to Max Kaiser, who is the guru, SwanBitcoin.com/Alex. Max, join us again very, very soon. Thank you. Have a great weekend.
Really insightful things about that Bitcoin. But don't know, you know, the problem is with all of this is at one time they outlawed the ownership of gold in this country. Well, could they just outlaw the holding of a Bitcoin account or Bitcoin period? Couldn't they do that? The federal government can just say outlaw Bitcoins. And anyone that possesses a Bitcoin or has an account is outside the federal law. So I don't know. They always come up with things to escape out of this net, this spider web of a net. And it's not always that easy to do. Coming up is an old speech by JFK about the secret societies, the secret, you know, organizations that are behind the scenes manipulating. And then we're going to play a clip from a very insightful clip from American intelligence media that delves into the Pilgrim Society and them in cahoots with Lenin before the Bolshevik Revolution in St. Petersburg, Russia. So here we go next with this really, really JFK prophetic speech.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence. And the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news. For it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
He said in there, the keeper of a man's conscience. You could say that the mainstream media is not a keeper of any legitimate, outstanding, upstanding, truthful conscience of any kind. And this is where the fake news is still out there, and it's working. And the dominance of just six companies that control a tremendous amount of our media and news and so forth is just overwhelmingly a monopoly to mesmerize and manipulate the people. What's coming up next is a couple of men that got together, and they've been working on this American intelligence media for a while. And one is Michael McKeven, and the other one is Gabriel, okay? And they together have come up with some very, very interesting things about the Pilgrim Society and how they were in cahoots with Lenin previous to the Bolsheviki Revolution. So we're going to play a clip of that right now.
Mike and Doug are going to talk about something that even takes our conspiracy theories we had known before and makes them pale in comparison. Hi, Mike. It's nice to see you instead of just hear you.
Yes, you're a good-looking man.
Thank you for lying. I appreciate that. I do know I have the face of a radio broadcaster. You know, one of the big theories is that Bolshevism was created in New York City. And it's not a theory, because you can trace it back to a bunch of the money coming from a group called the American International Corporation. And it was centered right on in New York City. And if you look closely, you'll see it. Some of those are bankers who recently got to New York and have tremendous amounts of money, and they just don't know what to do with it. So they decided to start an international corporation. And who did they sponsor? Lenin and Trotsky. This is very, very well known. But what you have discovered makes me feel sad that I'm a historian. I didn't know this, especially because I have a degree in British history. I didn't know.
So I'm going to blame you.
Please, because this is shocking. Okay. By the way, every Brit and every person we've shared this with says, I didn't know that. So, Jared, what is it that you found recently?
Oh, that's a great opening. The conclusions that we've drawn from the evidence is that the Pilgrim Society created Lenin and the Bolsheviks as a useful political tool for further takeover of German and Russian resources, and that from the beginning, Bolshevism was a play of the Pilgrim Society. And we now have, that's what happened.
That's quite shocking. Quite shocking, because I have characterized the Pilgrims as basically being the British East India Company pirates going in to take over the British government through the Privy Council. But now we see that they have this thing called settlements. I had no idea about that, but it seems as if they tried to make Russia into one of their settlements, which is a way to colonize.
And the Tsar kicked them out in 1909. The settlement movement was something that was the creation of John Ruskin, who was an early socialist in the middle part of the 1800s. And he counts as some of his followers, Alfred Milner and the folks, Cecil Rhodes and people like that. And it appeared, and this was it was an early form of communism that basically advocated that people from different class levels get together in communities and break down the old class structures that they were highly critical of, not without merit in some cases. But the point is, they always appointed a master or someone who was the leader or hierarch of these communities. And basically that concept really drove a whole new way of thinking that really borrowed heavily from Christianity, and somewhat from Judaism, and developed these communitarian philosophies. But they intentionally, were intending to create some sort of secular society or secular religion, because one of the things they talked about was the failure of love to be a moral arbiter or a moral guide, and they were going to replace it and have replaced it by their conceptions of social justice. Now, doesn't that sound contemporary?
It is so apropos to our day and age of Bernie democratic socialism. Really? Is someone really going to say socialism and think that that's a good thing politically or ideologically? Then are you going to say Marxism, Leninism, Bolshevism? How about fascism? Fascism, I've been recently looking into who might have influenced Cecil Rhodes and Joseph Chamberlain and some of those early people who were just these horrible white supremacist imperialists. And so I'm believing that it partially was influenced at least by Giuseppe Mazzini, who was really more or less the true father of fascism. He was the one who led the revolt in Italy to try to unify Italy again and again and again with the Carbonari and with Garibaldi. But he worked out of England again and again and again. He came back to England, and there he kept preaching this type of social moralism that actually can never really take place in the physical world and leads to fascism. It leads to what we actually have in inadvertent ways adopted into our own system here in America. So what you found was it's not just the American International Corporation that funded Lenin and Trotsky, but you found some of the other true sources, Mr. Peabody, who I had known Peabody was connected to Morgan, but I did not know that these bankers really were being instigated from the City of London to support this type of social experimentism and
yes.
fake ideologies.
Well, I think that the thing we have to realize is that what these people advocate as a political philosophy is that they want a shared community for everyone else except them. They want to be on top. They want to rule it. They want to control it, but they needed a mechanism for controlling the masses. And they, developed various forms of communitarian philosophy. I'll call it that, whether you call it democratic socialism or whether you call it socialism or Leninism or Bolshevism, it's all of the same cloth. And that's what was happening. They were developing these ideas, a lot of them by a guy named John Ruskin, who's quite an interesting fellow. And he even developed some early experiments in community life in England. And I think these guys, as they were looking how to reform the British Empire, they really saw this approach to be a counter to Christianity and to the Christian notions of love and brotherhood. And so they borrowed heavily from the structures, completely recast the definitions of all the words, and saw this as an opportunity to push this form of social control on the world, and just so long as they, as the Pilgrim Society, were controlling it. And that was really the key. And so what we discovered in 1909 was at the Imperial Press Conference of 1909, which was the first of its kind where the journalists from all over the empire came to London ostensibly to talk about the cost of telegrams and the role of journalism in society and the like. But on the side, under the covers, they were forming what we now know as MI5 and MI6 and GCHQ. That's what they were doing as a hidden agenda. And the prime minister was recruiting newspaper men from all over the world to be the first spies for Britain. And that, and you mentioned the British East India Company. Well, they were still incorporating the British East India Company and its armies and its merchants into the British Empire. And so it appears that this new way of organizing the empire was still very much in play. And so in 1909, they get together, and their first meeting on Monday, June 7th of 1909, was a meeting at the Parliament where they had a luncheon and they took photos, which we have, and they recorded everything they did, who was there, what they talked about, in a book that we just recently discovered. There weren't many of these books produced, but we found one in a warehouse in a library of a university in the Midwest. And in this book, there's a list of all the names of the people that were at this first meeting at the House of Commons. And most of them were very familiar, like Lord Northcliffe, Lord Burnham. Can you hear me? You went silent. And people like that. There was one name on there that we had no idea who this person was. His name was Mr. P.W. Wilson. And as we began investigating this person, we were shocked at what this guy represented, because separately, a researcher in England had discovered this P.W. Wilson in the archives relative to the five times that that Vladimir Lenin came to work and live in London. And P.W. Wilson, who was an MP at the time in 1905, hosted Lenin in his home during his about a month-long stay. And as we began to dig more into P.M. Wilson, we find at the time he was considered a radical liberal politician who was a member of Parliament, and he was a prolific writer who wrote heavily on what for him were interests. He had been an active churchgoer and had was working very hard to fuse his ideas, his understanding of Christianity with all these new settlement movements that were beginning to develop. And it looks as though they recruited him into the fold, because by 1909, he was a full-blown communist. And this researcher in England actually identified each of the locations where Lenin lived and worked, and what he was doing, who he was associating with. One of the he even resided on Tavistock Place, and that location actually by 1920 was the original office of the British Communist Party. So it appears that the Pilgrim Society, through this PM Wilson, was guiding and grooming Lenin to do their bidding in the what would become the Soviet Union way before 1917. So we're talking 8 years before he actually seized control.
What I found really interesting was that Philip Whitwell Wilson propagandized America and was so held in such great respect by president after president, four presidents in a row, as a matter of fact. And, of course, he was, as you pointed out, he was basically a spy who was hiding under the guise of being a journalist for the New York Times. And I liked what you insinuated, that he might have been the handler, the British handler of William Stevenson, Intrepid. An amazing thought, because William Stevenson went up to Canada, and what was he involved in? Broadcasting. And that was absolutely amazing. But I think what you have found is something that most people had no idea existed, which is that the city of London and the banksters were the incubators of Lenin, Marx, Stalin,
Yep.
A whole group of them, and also allowed Mazzini to stay there, who was basically the person who started one. He's founded Young Italy, Young Germany, Young Turkey, Young Turks. He founded these organizations that became radical fascist organizations that overthrew the government. And in a way, he certainly was an anti-monarchist. And I started thinking, well, here you got this great fascist. He's in Britain. And again, he's given money and he gets into Italy and he's trying to overthrow literally the Pope and everyone in Italy so that he can unite them as one underneath him. Benito Mussolini followed in his footsteps. Hitler followed in his footsteps. But then I started thinking, wait a second. Not only are the British certainly key people in creating the ideas of utopias, from Thomas More to Francis Bacon to so many others, that there's a utopian side of that, but that's what is for the masses. That is what's for the deluded masses. That is basically their opium. But it was this movement of the Pilgrim Society to create settlements that created kibbutz, that created settlements all over the British kingdom that was losing their foothold. And these settlements are really the pilgrims sent out from Britain in a way to these places to simply settle them for who? For the Brits. So the Zionists who really founded, and you look back to the Pikes-Pinocchio agreement from Versailles and Balfour and all these people who were involved in creating Zionism and Israel. Well, that's a settlement, and the kibbutz right. system is simply an extension of the Pilgrim Society attempting further political colonization of the world against even British interests. I mean, they sent Lord Milner to give money to the Tsar so that the monarchy wouldn't fall. What happened? Lord Milner, one man, said no. And then we see that they prepared Lenin again and again, gave him money, sheltered him again and again and again, especially by this particular journalist spy, Philip Whitwell Wilson. And then we see that they gave him money, put him on a train, and the money, at least a good portion of it, came from the American International Corporation, which is well known. But we now find out that it came from probably Peabody and Rothschild and perhaps Morgan, Hit Morgan's.
It came from J.P. Morgan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, JP, not his.
Peabody was gone, long gone. He died in Queen Victoria's day. But the bank he started became JP Morgan.
Yeah.
We're going to end this first hour with Dr. Pierre Corey. And he talked about ivermectin being a very good therapeutic against these virus infections. But anyway, we're just going to play that towards the end. Then I'll make just a brief comment there. And end the program. But anyway, this is Dr. Pierre Corey talking about ivermectin being an excellent therapeutic means against this virus. So here we go now, Dr. Pierre Corey.
I just want to start out. I didn't think I'd have to say this, but I want to register my offense at the ranking member's opening statement. I was discredited as a politician. I am a physician and a man of science. I've done nothing but commit myself to scientific truth and the care of patients. And to hear that I'm here because of a political angle, I am not a politician, I'm a physician. I want to start out by saying that I'm not speaking as an individual, I'm speaking on behalf of the organization that I'm a part of. We are a group of some of the most highly published physicians in the world. We have near 2,000 peer-reviewed publications among us, led by Professor Paul Marek, who's our intellectual leader. We came together early on in the pandemic, and all we have sought is to review the world's literature on every facet of this disease, trying to develop effective protocols. You just mentioned that I was here in May, and I recommended that it was critical that we use corticosteroids in this disease when all of the national and international healthcare organizations said we cannot use those. That turned out to be a life-saving recommendation. I am here again today with a new recommendation. In the last 9 months, in our review of all of the literature as a group, again, we are some of the most highly published physicians in our specialty and the world. we have done nothing but try to figure out how to identify a repurposed and available drug to treat this illness. We have now come to the conclusion after 9 months, and I have to point out, I am severely troubled by the fact that the NIH, the FDA, and the CDC, I do not know of any task force that was assigned or compiled to review repurposed drugs in an attempt to treat this disease. Everything has been about novel and or expensive pharmaceutically engineered drugs, things like tocilizumab and remdesivir and monoclonal antibodies and vaccines. We have 100 years of medicine development. We know we are expert in all the medicines we use, and I do not know of a task force that has been focused on repurposed drugs. I will tell you that my group and our organization, I will say that we have filled that void. That is all we have done is focus on the things we know and things we do. And I'm here to tell you, Dr. Ryder, he just presented. He has one study of the many that I want to talk about. And I want to talk about that we have a solution to this crisis. There is a drug that is proving to be of miraculous impact. And when I say miracle, I do not use that term lightly. And I don't want to be sensationalized when I say that. That is a scientific recommendation based on mountains of data that has emerged in the last 3 months. When I am told, and I just had to hear this in the opening sentence, that we are touting things that are not FDA or NIH recommended, let me be clear. The NIH, their recommendation on ivermectin, which is to not use it outside of controlled trials, is from August 27th. We are now in December. This is 3 to 4 months later. Mountains of data have emerged from many centers and countries around the world showing the miraculous effectiveness of ivermectin. It basically obliterates transmission of this virus. If you take it, you will not get sick. I want to briefly summarize the data. My manuscript, again, published by some of the most – we have contributed more to the medical knowledge of our specialty in our careers than anyone else can claim as a group. And our manuscript, which was posted on Medicine Preprint Server, details all of this evidence. I want to briefly summarize it. Number one, we have evidence that ivermectin is effective not only – in prophylaxis, in the prevention. If you take it, you will not get sick. We just came across a trial last night from Argentina by the lead investigator of ivermectin in Argentina, Dr. Hector Carvalho. They prophylaxed 800 healthcare workers. Not one got sick. In the 400 that they didn't prophylax with ivermectin, 58% got sick. 237 of those 400 got sick. If you take it, you will not get sick. It has immense and potent antiviral activity. We know that from the first study in Monash, it has made the bench to the bedside. Prophylaxis, we now have 4 large randomized controlled trials totaling over 1,500 patients, each trial showing that as a prophylaxis agent, it is immensely effective. You will not get sick. You will be protected from getting ill if you take it. In early outpatient treatment, we have 3 randomized controlled trials and multiple observation as well as case series showing that if you take ivermectin, the need for hospitalization and death will decrease. The most profound evidence we have is in the hospitalized patients. We have 4 randomized controlled trials there, multiple observation trials, all showing the same thing. You will not die, or you will die at much, much, much lower rates. Statistically significant, large magnitude results if you take ivermectin. It is proving to be a wonder drug. It has already won the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2015 for its impacts on global health in the eradication of parasitic diseases. It is proving to be an immensely powerful antiviral and anti-inflammatory agent. It is critical for its use in this disease. We, again, stand by our manuscript. It is a scientific manuscript. It's been submitted for peer review. But please recognize, peer review takes time. It takes months. We do not have months. We have 100,000 patients in the hospital right now dying. I'm a lung specialist. I'm an ICU specialist. I've cared for more dying COVID patients than anyone can imagine. They're dying because they can't breathe. They can't breathe. They're on high flow oxygen delivery devices. They're on non-invasive ventilators and or they're sedated and paralyzed and attached to mechanical ventilators that breathe for them. And I watch them every day. They die. By the time they get me in the ICU, they're already dying. They're almost impossible to recover. Early treatment is key. We need to offload the hospitals. We are tired. I can't keep doing this. If you look at my manuscript, and if I have to go back to work next week, any further deaths are going to be needless deaths, and I cannot be traumatized by that. I cannot keep caring for patients when I know that they could have been saved with earlier treatment, and that drug that will treat them and prevent the hospitalization is ivermectin. This is, I am here today, I'm calling to action. The NIH, their last recommendation was August 27th. August 27th. I want to be clear. I am not here as a politician or a dramatist or sensationalizing what I'm recommending. I am going to be very clear and very simple. All I ask is for the NIH to review our data that we've compiled of all of the emerging data. We have almost 30 studies. Everyone is reliably and reproducibly positive, showing the dramatic impacts of ivermectin. Please, I'm just asking that they review our manuscript. It is a serious manuscript by serious, highly experienced physicians and researchers. I cannot call on more credibility than we have. We're not just a random doctor who's saying that we have a cure. I don't want to say I have a cure. I'm just asking review our data. We have immense amounts of data to show that ivermectin must be implemented and implemented now. Senator, the last thing I want to say is, you know who's dying here? It's our African-American and Latino and elderly. It's some of the most disadvantaged and impoverished members of our society. They are dying at higher rates than anyone else. It's the most severe discrepancy I've seen in my medical career. And we are responsible to protect those disadvantaged members. We have a special duty to provide countermeasures. The amount of evidence to show that ivermectin is life-saving and protective is so immense, and the drug is so safe. My colleagues have talked about it. It must be instituted and implemented. I am asking the NIH to review our data and come up with recommendations for society. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank Dr. Corey. And I will make you this guarantee that before the day is out, we'll have a letter. First of all, we'll enter all your data into our hearing record, and then I'll have a letter to the NIH asking them to review it.
Okay? Please, and
thank hopefully
you.
I'll have some senators join me in that.
One of the questions that I'd like to ask, and I think this is the difficulty of proving the situation on either ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, is that because so many people get better, you know, the control group might be 99% of the people get better. Then you give hydroxychloroquine to this same group, and you might get 99.5%. It's going to be a difficult thing to actually prove in trials that you get a benefit. It sounds like in some of the sicker patients where you had a mortality, you know, where you had a 25% mortality down to 15%, that does sound significant. Now you're getting into the sicker patients. With the outpatient studies, one of the critiques is that so many people get better naturally. How are you proving that it's statistically significant? And what comes to my mind is sort of like when we wanted to prove that aspirin, taking an aspirin a day was good to prevent heart attacks. It took like 10 years and 10,000, you know, people in the study because it was just hard to show the differences of whether an aspirin worked or not. I think the same thing is true with either hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin in an outpatient setting, is that because so many people get better on their own. The converse is when you're really sick. Because it's hard to get to treat people who are very sick. It's hard to prove that anything works when people are very sick. But I guess what I'd like to do is open it for the panel one by one to explain how we answer the critique that most of these people are getting better anyway. So how you've proven that your treatment works in a group of people who didn't go to the hospital, so that you're selecting out actually for the people who may well have been, you know, did you prevent them from getting seriously sick? Or have you selected out as your patient pool because they're outpatient, tending to be people who are going to get better? Why don't we'll start with those who are here. We'll start with Dr. Oskwi, and then we'll go to Dr. Corey.
Senator Paul, I appreciate your question, and it's critical, the content of your question, which is how can we tell when something's working when many patients get better? And there's only one answer to that. And we know what that is, and it's one of the central tenets of science, which is you need a control group. You need to have a group that is comparable to those that you treat, and then you compare them to those that you don't treat. What I am trying to message today is in our manuscript, we now have 11 randomized controlled trials. Every one of those controlled trials show that in the ivermectin-treated group, lives are saved, There's less need for hospitalization. There's less transmission, less case counts. It is a fundamentally and powerfully effective therapy against COVID-19. We need the NIH to review these data. We have the data. Let me say, the amount of patients in those randomized controlled trials, the 11 trials, total, nearly 4,000, with over half treated with ivermectin. Let's remind ourselves that the treatment of COVID-19 fundamentally changed after the recovery trial was announced in June. That was a trial of 6,000 patients. 2,000 were treated with steroids, and it showed the dramatic and life-saving properties of corticosteroids. Almost overnight, the treatment of COVID-19 changed as a result of that trial. That was the recovery trial. I am presenting a paper today with more patients treated with ivermectin with larger magnitudes of benefit than the recovery trial. I will maintain that ivermectin should be the standard of care of this disease based on these data. It's not my opinion. It's the data. We have the data. If you give anyone else a placebo based on the data that's in our manuscript, I believe that would be malpractice, and you would lead to the heightened risk of death. More placebo is needed.
So the 11 studies are inpatient or inpatient and outpatient?
They vary. So the randomized controlled trials, I almost can't describe what this data shows. People need to read the manuscript. We have four randomized controlled trials in prophylaxis, each and every one highly statistically significant. Patients or people, even citizens, healthy citizens on ivermectin, do not get COVID.
And you're comparing it to placebo in these studies? You're comparing it to this other
thing? Yes. So in the prophylaxis studies alone, which is four, they took COVID-19 patients who tested positive for COVID-19. They identified their household members. They gave them ivermectin. So they had a whole group of household contacts of COVID-19 patients who took ivermectin. The other households, they didn't give ivermectin. Every single randomized controlled trial shows that in the households that were on ivermectin, drastically reduced rates of transmission. The households did not get sick. You can protect people from this disease with ivermectin. That's just the prophylaxis trials. The outpatient trials.
So the outcome tested was how many people were positive, turned out positive?
How many people were positive or how many people got symptoms? And they were drastically, statistically significant. These are and from multiple centers and countries around the world. That's just the prophylaxis. We also have trials on early outpatient as well as hospital. The most dramatic is the hospital. Each, almost every single one, we have four large randomized controlled trials in the hospital, all statistically significant reductions in mortality. Dr. Ryder has a large observational control trial from Broward County, and he's here on the panel today. In his trial, he also showed the same. The patients who got ivermectin died at far less rates.
And opponents of using ivermectin, have they responded to these, critiqued these? Has there been a generalized argument that they make, or is it silence?
So the opponents, again, I want to call attention to the NIH and their recommendation. I don't say that they're an opponent. They made their last recommendation on ivermectin on August 27th, which is either 10 years ago or 4 months ago. I don't know which. August 27th, this was their recommendation. We recommend against the use of ivermectin outside of clinical trials. That recommendation was based on expert opinion only. There was no data to recommend or recommend against. It was an expert opinion.
Thank you for listening tonight. Check out our website, thesecrettruth.com. We have some click-offs up there on what's going on down at that immigration down on the border. And we also have some other click-offs also to look into. But thank you for listening tonight, and God bless each and every one of you.